Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, listeners. Toss your dicky towels down and put some zinc cream on your schnoz as I welcome you to another Late Night Live on Radio National Summer. In this program, we bring together the dangerous worlds of espionage and cyber warfare. Later on, we talk to the incredibly sprightly 97-year-old Chapman Pincher, whose journalism during the Cold War alerted the country to the infiltration of Britain's security services by spies loyal to the Soviet. But first to the imminent threat of cyber war. As the country that invented the internet, the US is the most wired nation in the world, but woefully lacking in proper cyber defence. The former head of US National Intelligence, Admiral Mike McConnell, warned that America is losing the cyber war, and I quote, "No flotilla of ships or intercontinental missiles or standing armies can defend against such remote attacks located not only beyond our borders, but beyond physical space in the digital ether." Robert Kanocki is an international affairs fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also the co-author with Richard Clark of Cyber War, the next threat to national security and what to do about it. Spoke to him earlier this year from Washington, asked for a quick definition of cyber war.
When we wrote this book, our focus was to make the case that there really is something called warfare that is being prepared for and that is taking place in cyberspace. It's different from cybercrime. It's different from espionage. It's different from hacktivism or other malevolent activity. And what it is politically motivated violence in cyberspace that is being sponsored by or carried out by militaries to further their real world objectives.
Robert, I'd like you to talk briefly to one example, which may be an example, because you talk about it somewhat ambiguously, the 2007 Israeli bombing of that suspected nuclear arms factory in Syria.
Sure. So this is a case where allegedly the Israelis used a cyber attack vehicle to disrupt and disable the Syrian air defense system. So instead of jamming it the way that you normally would by flooding it with some part of the electromagnetic spectrum so the radar couldn't see where your aircraft were, they actually took over the computers that controlled the air defense system. And by doing that, the Syrians didn't even know they were under attack. They thought their systems were working normally. They thought that what they were seeing on their screens was, in fact, what was in the sky. They had no idea that, in fact, the Israelis had taken over the system, and while they were doing that, they were flying their jets to their target and were able to get in and get out without the Syrians ever being able to fire a shot off.
Robert, that is quite astonishing. And yet here's the U.S., infinitely better equipped, one would think, to deal with this sort of an issue. In your view, almost on its knees, lacking a clear strategy. Is it because there's a lack of clear strategy, or is it because there's a lack of sufficient resources?
I think what happened is we got a little bit ahead of ourselves. We got very excited with what all this technology could do and really how cheap it was to spread computers around the globe and create what we call the global information grid and increase our dependence on these systems to give us an advantage, without realizing that that also created a vulnerability. I think for a while we thought we were the only ones who understood these technologies and could use them, and then that turned out not to be the case. There was an example about 6 months ago where it was revealed that the Taliban in Afghanistan had been able to intercept the unencrypted video feeds from our Predator drones there and were able to watch them and knew where they were and knew what targets they were going after because of that.
They couldn't deflect them at this point, but they could watch them coming.
but they could watch them coming. And so the fact that those streams were unencrypted sort of suggested to many people, gee, we really just thought that these guys were so dumb and this was so hard that they didn't need to be secure. And I think that tells you the sort of overall attitude. Right now, I think our military has gotten the message and is very focused on remediating those technical vulnerabilities. And then in addition to that, they're very focused on developing their offensive capabilities and their doctrine for their use.
But Robert, when you say the military, are the Army, Navy, and Air Force all reading on the same page?
At this point, there is a very strong effort to make sure that they are. This creation of Cyber Command, in my opinion, was really an effort to get the different branches of the armed forces operating from the same playbook, with the same strategy, with the same doctrine, so that you didn't have the Air Force running in one direction and the Navy running in another direction and the Marines and the Army off on the sideline fighting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. That was the reason that Cyber Command was stood up, and I believe it has thus far been fairly effective in reining in the different services.
So you and your co-author give that at least a diagonal nod.
I would say so. I would say the problem is we established Cyber Command without any what you might call offsetting diplomatic action to prevent the rest of the world from being scared by it. And so the problem with Cyber Command is it was set up, but it wasn't clear why it was being set up. And most other countries seemed to assume the worst, and they began preparing for cyber warfare, and they set up their own Cyber Commands. And right now we're seeing a bit of a cyber arms race globally.
So now, given that your incredibly clever civilization, your nation, sort of invented the damned internet, have they built flaws into it? Was none of this foreseeable?
I think that it really probably wasn't foreseeable, but for your first question, you're absolutely right. They did build flaws into it. The original technologies were designed for a handful, maybe no more than 100 researchers at 60 institutions who all had security clearances and all had Defense Department contracts to exchange information. So that is to say, the protocols that govern today's internet were built for a small, trusted group of researchers who were not doing the kinds of things that we do today over the internet. They weren't conducting commerce. They weren't controlling industrial systems. And so we're still using those basic protocols that were designed for this very limited, narrow, small scale on this global scale. And that's one of the reasons we've had so many problems. That's one of the reasons there is cyber insecurity globally at this point.
My guest is Robert K. Kanucky, International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Robert, you've made emphasized the point, we're talking about cyber war, not other forms of cyber manipulation or attack. Nonetheless, the ABC, from whom I'm broadcasting, reported at length recently on cyber attacks coming from a country not too far away from China, aimed at mining companies in Australia, basically, I guess, for espionage purposes. Now, are US corporations better equipped than perhaps government to ward off this sort of interference?
I think the answer is largely no. If you think about it this way, saying that the private sector can handle the threat of cyber warfare on their own and government doesn't need to be involved would be a little bit like General Motors or Lockheed Martin being told during the Cold War they had to provide their own nuclear deterrence, so they should go out and purchase their own bombers and their own nuclear missiles. That's not realistic in that scenario, and I don't think it's realistic in this scenario. There's no way that even the best-equipped private company can defend against a determined nation-state adversary that's going to be pulling all the resources and all the capability of their military and intelligence community.
Robert, does the U.S. military, which is completely dependent on the Internet for its operations, logistics, command and control, fleet positioning, even targeting, does the U.S. military have a plan B if the system comes crashing down? Have they still kept some pencils and paper around?
That's certainly the argument that is favored by many cybersecurity strategists, that what you need to do is ensure that you can return to manual operations, that you don't get rid of your first-generation technology when replacing it with the third or fourth. And it's probably a very, very good strategy. As to whether the United States military has taken that approach, I could not comment on that.
Could you comment on the feasibility of going back an era in communications and logistics systems and being operational? Is it feasible anymore?
I think we're at a turning point where it does remain feasible, but as we invest in these new technologies and eliminate redundancy for the sake of efficiency, we may put ourselves in a position where it's not. So right now, we are able to operate in a disaster, for instance, in a country like Haiti, going in where there is no infrastructure and set up new infrastructure to bring in new cellular towers, to use older radio technologies that aren't reliant on modern infrastructure. But
One of the things you write about, which I found absolutely fascinating, is that the Chinese government has the power and the means to disconnect itself from the internet, and therefore the rest of the world, if they felt they were about to suffer an attack of cyber warfare. Does the U.S. have that capability?
The U.S. does not have that capability. There is a question about whether the United States should have that capability. It's being debated in Congress right now.
Oh, is it? Is it being debated on party lines, or is this is it getting a more skillful and reasonable debate?
Generally, I think both parties in the United States fear more government control over the internet. There's a myth in the United States that the internet was a private sector effort and that the private sector should be left alone to manage it. That doesn't fit in with historic reality, and I think it really doesn't work.
So there today. Is, so it is being ideologically argued, and there's also this fact that the Chinese regard it as a national grid, and as well as an international grid, and there isn't the private property aspect.
I think that that's important, but I think that it's also important to realize that the United States is almost unique. Most other countries have much stronger control over their portions of the internet, over their backbones and over their internet service providers. And in many countries, including many Western countries, those companies are actually state-owned. So in reality, the rest of the world looks more like China does than the United States does.
In your book, you recommend a ban on cyber warfare against civilian infrastructure. Would this prevent the likelihood of a cyber attack escalating into a larger scale war?
That's our argument. Our concern is that if you look over the many centuries of warfare, when offense dominates, warfare is more likely. And right now in cyberspace, offense is tremendously dominant. It's very hard to protect these infrastructures. It's very easy to attack them. And so what we've been arguing is that you need to have a construct in which warfare is limited and in which consequences are created outside of cyberspace to increase the cost for engaging in cyber war.
That was Robert Konecki, author of Cyber War, published by Echo Books, ECCO Books. Late Night Live on Radio National Summer, coming up, the world of espionage with Chapman Pincher.